The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Well, we have a very busy news afternoon for you. Coming up at 12:30, Christopher Rufo is going to join us and talk about the Seattle Whiteness Seminar that they had for City of Seattle employees. Some of the details are going to absolutely blow your mind. In just a few minutes, David Gerke, the attorney for Mary Kay Letourneau, who passed away this week at age 58. She was the tabloid sensation, and David Gerke became a very good friend of this radio show when this story first broke 23 years ago, even though he and I passionately disagreed about Mary Kay Letourneau. I thought she was a child rapist. He was, he said, but Dory, they are actually truly in love. And indeed, she ended up marrying the student that she started having sex with when he was 12, but they got married when he became an adult, and they stayed married for 13, 14 years, and he was by her side, even though they had gotten divorced when she died. So we'll talk to David Gerke about the bizarre life and now death of Mary Kay Letourneau. That's in just a couple of moments. Let's get right to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. I told you so.
So for months now, as Seattle's been burning, as Chaz and Chop have raged, as teenagers have been gunned down, as people are getting run over on I-5. I've told you that this was never about social justice. It was never about police violence. But there were very powerful Marxist forces that were using, essentially, on a national level, they were using the horrible, tragic murder of George Floyd, which should be punished to the fullest extent of the law, but they were using that as their cover for this agenda that has been making its way throughout our country. I'm going to replay for you. I had this audio late in the show yesterday. I'm a little stunned that it's gotten almost no attention in the local media. But what I've been telling you about this Marxist movement and about Kshama Sawant, who is an avowed Marxist, a member of Socialist Alternative, a Marxist group that wants to destroy capitalism, that wants to destroy our society, our American society, as we know it. It's not me just making up things about her. She finally has admitted that in her own words as she was spiking the football about the Seattle business tax, the business tax that's the largest in our city's history.
I have a message for Jeff Bezos and his class. If you attempt again to overturn the Amazon tax, working people will go all out in the thousands to defeat you. And we will not stop there, because you see, we are fighting for far more than this tax. We are preparing the ground for a different kind of society. And if you, Jeff Bezos, want to drive that process forward by lashing out against us in our modest demands, then so be it, because we are coming for you and your rotten system. We are coming to dismantle this deeply oppressive, racist, sexist, violent, utterly bankrupt system of capitalism, this police state. We cannot and will not stop until we overthrow it and replace it with a world based instead on solidarity, genuine democracy, and equality. A socialist world. Thank you.
I played that soundbite on my show yesterday afternoon. How has that gotten no attention elsewhere? None. I mean, I'm an elected member of the Seattle City Council who is sworn to uphold our Constitution, saying that she wants to dismantle our way of government. I mean, this is a huge story. And it cannot simply be dismissed as, that's Sawant being Sawant. Sawant now has Tammy Morales by her side and a radicalized city council that wants to spread this throughout King County and throughout the Puget Sound region and throughout the state. But there she is saying that they want to dismantle capitalism, replace it, and she says socialism, but again, read the documents of Socialist Alternative. They are a communist organization. They want a government takeover of our society. Ilhan Omar, The congresswoman from from Minnesota said the same thing on a national level yesterday. And this is this insidious force driven by very powerful, very rich Marxist millionaires, billionaires, that have been pushing this throughout our nation. I'm going to keep reminding you of that soundbite because it proves everything that I've been saying about her, about the agenda that's at play. It's never been about social justice. It's never been about police violence. It is about overturning our government as we know it. And now, a Dory Monson Show exclusive, up next in The Big Lead.
The Big Lead, Dory Monson Show exclusive.
Well, it was way back early in my career. It's just my second year on this show, back in 1997, when a local story broke that really shook the nation and the world and got everybody talking. It was the story of a school teacher here, Mary Kay Letourneau, who had sex with a student that was 12 years old when he was in her classroom. And as we talked about this story, I mean, it seemed like it was almost daily. And I really became buddies with Mary Kay Letourneau's attorney, even though we disagreed passionately on some of the issues within that story. David Gerke was very good friend to my show very early on, and he was a friend to Mary Kay Letourneau right until she passed this week from cancer at age 58. David Gerke joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. David, my friend, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you, Dory, and thank you for having me back. Who'd have thought when we first met all those years ago that we'd still be talking about the same subject?
Yeah, and, I know. It's crazy.
And here we are, and it was I knew it was coming, and still when I heard the news yesterday, it hurt.
I actually heard the news on Monday, and I don't know who it was from. Somebody texted me on our show text line Monday afternoon and said that Mary Kay Letourneau had passed, and I started doing searches. I couldn't find anything. I thought it was maybe a hoax, and all the news stories said that she passed yesterday, Tuesday, but I got a text informing me.
It was Monday, and I didn't find out about the death until yesterday myself.
Okay. So you said it was known. Did you have chances to talk to her in the last few months?
I ran into her once. She obviously was not vibrant, was not anxious to see people and all of that. I did run into her and exchanged greetings and best wishes, and She ended up homebound, bedbound, and that's where she passed. She just was not out and about near the end.
I'll tell you something that really struck me. Her son emailed me last night and said, "Do you want a statement from the family?" And I said, "Absolutely." I asked him if he wanted to talk about his mother's life, and he said, "You know, understandably, this has created quite the turmoil." He seems like a very nice young man, even though they grew up in a maelstrom, as such a tabloid story. But what struck me, David, was the statement was from the Fulau and Letourneau families, and as I understand it, even though she and Vili Fulau had split up in 17, gotten divorced at least a year ago, that they were still close right up until the end. Is that right?
That is correct. And they both grew up a lot, if you will, over the last couple of decades, and didn't always see eye to eye. But the love between them, it was always there. Strong. And Billy, to his credit, when he found out about it, and then especially the last couple of months, he moved back from California, and he gave her 24/7 care, literally all the way to the end. And that was the love they had.
And David, as I've been watching all the coverage today, the story is teacher who raped her 12-year-old student. That was something you and I disagreed passionately on. Back when the story was first breaking, to me it was just that. It was a teacher who had committed statutory rape. If it was a male teacher and a 12-year-old girl, nobody would have joked about it. And yet I'd get all these messages from guys. I wish I'd had a teacher like that when I was 12 years old. And that always bothered me. But you always had a very different perspective on that relationship. Has that changed at all over the years?
No. And I'll refresh your memory. I said Mary's case was different, and I had known Mary for a couple of years. I had known her children, and that's what made it different. I agreed that there should not be some sort of a self-defense argument of, well, they were in love. Whether they were or not, you cannot change the law to allow that, because a good groomer will have the victim in love with them just to get laid. But in Mary's case, I do firmly believe that it's love. And I think the decades-long loving relationship up to the very end sort of shows that this was that one exception. And again, you can't have an exception in the law, or as bad as things are in the world, it'd be horrendous if you start and say, well, just, you know, if she says she loved you, we'll let it go. No. Right. But she persevered. I always argued with her. I never told her it couldn't be love. But what I told her is, Mary, you were the adult, and the law says you have to remain an adult until he is. You can't be breaking the law just because of love. And she finally understood that. She never agreed with it because they were in love. But she understood that there had to be. And then as her daughters got older, we would argue once in a while. And I'd just say, what if it was your daughter? Well, that would be different. And I said, okay, I rest the case.
Yeah, no, there always was a, you know, very much a gender double standard on this. And yet, you know, as you said, I think most of us were shocked when they years later actually did get married, and that they stayed married for, what was it, almost 20 years or 15 years?
May 20th, 2005.
Okay, so I guess, you know, 13, 15 years that they, or 14 years that they stayed married. So, yeah, that defied all expectations. And we should also remind people, she didn't initially go to jail for having sex with him. She got probation, and then she was caught in a car with steamed up windows when she was prohibited from seeing him, and it was more that probation violation that eventually landed her in prison, right?
Well, yes, but it wasn't just a probation violation. She was sentenced to 7 years in prison. That was her sentence. If she's successfully completed the sexual deviancy program and stayed away from contact with him, she only had to do 6 months. And as soon as she did the 6 months and she got out in late December of that year, and it turns out she was already seeing him probably almost the day she got out. And then they got caught in early February in the car with the steamy windows, having come from the movie Wag the Dog or Wag the Tail, that I forgot who was in it.
Yeah.
They'd had a couple of beers in the theater, and it was like a couple of older teenagers. And a lot of times Mary was that older teenager, not an adult. And that caused her a lot of trouble. And then when she got caught, Judge Yu very properly and fairly said, you had your chance. You squandered a golden opportunity. And Mary went to prison.
And you know, when you say that they were genuinely in love, was there something, and, you know, pardon my lack of better language, but was there something screwy about her just emotionally, in that, you know, a 33-year-old teacher and a 12-year-old boy, was there just something going on that was well off with her?
I've said this, and she knows I've said it, and she does not like me to say it. Right when this case was breaking, I got two phone calls. One was a retired Department of Correction psychologist. The other was a dentist. The psychologist said something happened to her in her childhood about the same age that Billy is now, and it derailed her. It's like you're driving from New York to L.A. and you have a problem in Pennsylvania and you go the wrong direction. And that's why she's acting this way. And then I had a dentist who called, and it happened with his daughter, very similar circumstances. And they discovered she was bipolar. And when you're in the manic phase, you act recklessly, whether it's financially or undertaking projects that you have no hope of completing, sexually, things like that. And yeah. Mary had a couple of setbacks in her life.
Understood.
And, well, and so when you say, was she squirrely, she was suffering from this. And it, I think that kept her from being the adult.
Yeah, I get it. Okay, we only have a few seconds left. How's her family? Because they grew up in, you know, just being the subject through no fault of their own of this sensational tabloid story. How are they all doing?
They are all doing great. They are one very strong, integrated family, all the kids. And as big as it was back then for you and me, the kids, they moved to Alaska, the four older ones. They were just the Laternos. That wasn't that stigma. And the younger ones, you know, you'll find someone that's in high school today, and do you know the Laterno story? And huh? Who? Yeah. So they weren't really stigmatized as bad as they could have been.
David, it's good talk with you. And I know that you were not just a passionate defender as an attorney, but I know that you grew very close with her. I'm sorry for everybody's yeah. loss here.
Thank you. Thank you. And great talking to you.
You
Take
too.
Care of yourself.
Yes, sir.
Bye.
David Gerke, the yeah. attorney for Mary Kay Laterno. And that is your Big Lead for today.
The Big Lead on Cairo Radio.
Lots more straight ahead. Are you white? Well, the city of Seattle says you got a lot of things wrong with you then. But they had a seminar to help you correct your whiteness. Wait until you hear the details of this seminar the city of Seattle gave its workers. It's coming up next on the Dory Monson Show. Well, as we discuss all the madness that has enveloped our region, our friend Christopher Rufo, community activist, editor at City Journal, he has uncovered a City of Seattle segregated training session on how to undo whiteness. And some of the documents from this training session are simply unbelievable. Christopher Rufo joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Chris, always good to talk with you.
Likewise.
Tell me how you found out about this that led you to request the documents that were used for this undoing whiteness seminar.
Yeah, I had received a tip from someone who was familiar with this training from the city of Seattle and had sent an email that was detailing this event. And from their Office of Civil Rights had sent out an invitation specifically to white employees to attend this training session. On essentially undoing whiteness, interrupting their own internalized racial superiority. And it seemed so outlandish that I wanted to get more detail. So I submitted a records request and got a kind of trove of documents for this truly radical and highly ideological training that was specifically targeted to the white employees of the city of Seattle.
Well, and what's amazing reading through it, Chris, is it's almost like, not almost like, it looks like and reads like a parody of what this radical wokeness sounds like, and yet it's the reality that people have to deal with. And so, I mean, let's go through some of these things. So they talked about, first of all, it's almost like it's not in English. Some of the sentences that they throw together. They said, we'll examine our complicity in the system of white supremacy, how we internalize and reinforce it, and begin to cultivate practices that enable us to interrupt racism in ways to be accountable to BIPOC folks within our community. I mean, it would take me about a half hour to figure out what that sentence even means.
Yeah, I'm in the kind of unenviable position that I've been exposed to this stuff for so long, I can kind of parse it. It's almost a foreign language. But what they're basically done with this training session, you see that they've reduced the world to two essential forces. There's the kind of essential category of blackness, and then there's the essential category of whiteness. And it really is almost like a new metaphysics. They're basically saying this is the new science of good and evil. And it's up to the white employees at the city of Seattle to essentially atone for their sins, to work through their feelings of guilt and complicity in white supremacy. And it sets up an impossible task, because at one time, they never really explain what is racist behavior, what are the racist attitudes that you want to prevent. It's really just this all-encompassing, pervasive kind of metaphysics of whiteness that you are stuck with for your entire life. And what I think is very interesting is that the training, as you see it laid out in the documentation, is really kind of a point by point kind of induction into this cult of social justice and racial activism. And I think it's astonishing, and it would be really scandalizing to most people to know that their taxpayer dollars are going to fund this kind of toxic ideology.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they talked about self-talk. So they were instructing white employees to walk around and tell themselves that while we might not be racist, we are responsible for racism. And what about all the white people who work for the city of Seattle who are not racist, who look at people just by the content of their character and don't evaluate people by the color of their skin? And the city of Seattle is telling them, no matter how they live their life, no matter how they have treated people and reacted to people their whole life, that they have to do self-talk, that they are responsible for racism. And I just think that's a horribly damaging message.
It really is. And I think that what they're essentially trying to have you do is they're trying to dismantle all of the categories of normative kind of well-established thinking. And if you look at their document, what they say is something that I think is really disturbing and surprising. They say that the values of individualism, intellectualization, and even objectivity are actually values of white supremacy and go to uphold the white supremacist social order. And it's really bizarre for two reasons. One, because I think it's patronizing to people of color to essentially say that they are can't hold the values or don't hold the values of things like intellectualization or individualization. But also they're trying to undermine the very idea of objectivity. And they're doing that, I think, because they want to really kind of wipe away any of your pre-existing thinking. The first step in any cult induction is to break down all of the relationships and ideas and patterns you had before to make you unsure of even the objective facts of the world. And then they can really fill your head with their what they call anti-racism. But I think it's more accurately described as this kind of new kind of racial division mindset.
Well, and I mean, just to dive in a little deeper on what you were just referencing, they had a list of internalized racial oppression words, and you have internalized racial superiority if you believe in individualism, paternalism, comfort is on the list, objectivity. So all of those things, comfort, objectivity, objectivity, it all makes you internally a racist somehow, according to the city of Seattle.
Yeah, it does. And it's almost inexplicable. And I think that if you talk to people or engage with people within these settings, the kind of racial justice training that every city of Seattle employee has to go through, it probably makes sense in their own insular world. But I think what this release of these documents have shown is that once these insular ideas make contact with the broader society, people are upset because they think that it's a waste of money. They think it's kind of academic jargon. And then people see very clearly that this ideology is extremely toxic and actually goes to create more division, more hatred, more uncertainty, and really contributes to all those things that it claims to be fighting against.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, but that's I mean, that's what this whole radical movement is about. It is about creating victims. It is about telling people that you, despite whatever aspirations you have to individuality, you are victims of collectivity. And that's how you control people. If you can, if you convince them, and this starts in kindergarten in our public schools, but if you convince people that they are victims and that they have no chance unless government somehow saves them from all of these unseen evil monsters, in this case white people apparently, according to the city of Seattle, but that isn't that how they control people? And it's by instilling fear and by reducing individuality.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And after I released these documents, I got a lot of incoming messages from people who are employees of the city of Seattle, employees of King County, employees of even the state and federal governments. And they all tell me we're doing the same thing in my department, the same thing in my department. There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of these kind of racial justice trainings going on all across the United States. And the common thing that people said is they said, I totally disagreed with this, but I didn't feel like I could speak out because I would pay a price with my career. I would be mocked or ridiculed by the trainers, and it feels like there's no room for dissent. So what's happening is that the bureaucracy of all levels of American government are now being radicalized into this political religion. And I think that we have to collectively expose it. We have to tell the truth about what's happening, and we have to stamp it out now before it spreads too far and too wide and gains too much power within our public institutions.
Well, there are a million things I could cite in all these documents you obtained, Chris, but I guess I'll end with this one. Here's the, according to the city of Seattle, message to all white people, here's how you know you've interrupted your whiteness. And they have three things. When you implicate yourself in racism, when other white people may be angry, and when you have stopped your white normative behavior. At that point, according to the city of Seattle, you have successfully interrupted your whiteness. This might be one of the most racist government documents I've ever seen in my life, Chris.
I know. You know, it I think like I've moved beyond the stage of being upset about these things, because at this point it's just farcical. It's absurd. It's something that you should mock and laugh at, because the people who are pushing this are totally clueless. None of this is supported by any kind of scientific or philosophical evidence. It's pure garbage, and I think we need to call it out for what it is. And I'm waiting now on the final kind of part of my records request to find out exactly who did this training and how much were they paid, because I think that's critical information. And we need to hold the people who are organizing this, this philosophy of hatred, we need to hold them accountable and let people know where exactly their taxpayer dollars are going.
Where's the best place to send my listeners if they want to read your distillation of what you have so far?
Sure. You can go to my website, ChristopherRufo.com. That's ChristopherRufo.com. Just this morning, I posted all of the original source documents, so you can read everything and see for yourself.
Okay. It is an unbelievable read. It is, you know, like you just said, at the same time, it's infuriating and just comical. Chris, great, great work. I know this has gotten national traction. And as I told you last time we talked, I love having watchdogs out there like you that I can talk with. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Keep it up.
All right, you bet. Christopher Rufo joining us. Go to ChristopherRufo.com to see all of what he found. It'll blow your mind. All right, love to hear your thoughts. You can text us at 98973. And we have lots more straight ahead here on the Dory Monson Show. So the debate rages on. Should we open schools in the fall? To me, the answer is just so obviously yes, just because is there any risk to the kids? It's almost zero. And there's increasing evidence that kids are not potent carriers of coronavirus. But anything in the debate has to be counterbalanced with, if they stay at home, how much damage that's doing to our kids. And online learning has proven to be a joke. I mean, you know, the Shoreline schools can go ahead and sit first graders in front of an anti-cop storybook. That ain't teaching. And I had one of my, this was so bizarre. One of my former basketball girls, when I was coaching at the high school, I ran into them. They said, "Hey, saw you in class today." I go, "What are you talking about?" They had an online class, and they played a 27-year-old episode of Bill Nye the Science Guy, where I had a recurring role as Lance Yardstick. Pat Cashman was Timmy Ticker, and I was Lance Yardstick, and we were sportscasters who, you know, did play-by-play of sporting events that described science in those terms. But, and that's why every 6 months or so, I get a residual check from Disney. I often post those on Twitter because they're so funny. I'll get a check for 23 cents for the three or four episodes of Bill Nye that I did 27 years ago. But that's online learning. You sit a kid on a computer in front of a 27-year-old episode of Bill Nye the Science Guy. So there's no learning going on at home. I'm hearing that from parents. I'm hearing that from teachers. You know, this ridiculous, we're not going to flunk anybody. Well, the kids knew that. They didn't. We're not going to have letter grades. So the kids knew that they could give maximum effort or minimal and have the same results. And so academically, it's smothering our kids. Kids, as they're separated from their peers, they're depressed, they're anxious, teen suicide is up, and everybody's wringing their hands about sending kids back to school. But I'm going to talk about this later this afternoon. I want to hear from parents. Do you want your kids back in school? Text me, 98973. That's 98973. I'll share some of your comments as the Dory Monson Show rolls on.